Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Ventham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. This week we're talking about marriage. Whether you're hoping to get married one day, whether you're a newlywed or many, many years into marriage, like Grandad Graham, it's always helpful to revisit and review the key attributes of a God-shaped marriage. Marriage should be really beautiful and an enjoyable thing, but clearly comes with its own challenges too, as distinct from the challenges of singleness. So let's talk about that, and I'll catch you on the other side.
Hi, I'm Mark Bentham.
Hello, and I'm Graham Nichols.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. This week on the podcast, we are talking about marriage. It's kind of a follow-up episode to our last week's episode on singleness, where we had Keturah Adshead, and she is still with us.
Yay! Hello! Well, I never went anywhere. Still here.
That's the illusion. You've broken the illusion. No, we do record these in bunches. So Keturah is still here, and we're going to talk today.
She's still here.
She's still here. She's decided to stick around.
She's waiting for a coffee that was promised.
Yeah, that only happens after two recordings. Yeah,
so she's just very nice coffees.
Yeah,
great.
We do the best here at Ordinary HQ. Yeah. Why are we talking about marriage this week?
Well, why are we talking about marriage, Graham? No, because singleness, very important area of church life. Lots of people are single. Lots of people are married. Probably the most significant relationship after our relationship with the Lord that we have. So how do we do that in a way that is Christ-honoring, that reflects the importance of what marriage upholds in the Bible? And how can we help one another with our marriages to be God-honoring?
Probably worth saying we're all married here, all four of us.
We are. And how long have you been married, Josh?
I have been married for 5 years.
You had to just work that out then, didn't
you? Yeah, well, because I got married in the same summer as Keturah.
Yep.
So I just asked her.
Didn't realise that.
But you were slightly earlier than us.
Yeah, we were July 2014. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't got married since the last... As in, sound like I was single in the last podcast. And I just got married into the next
In the, like, five-minute gap between recordings.
Yeah, 2014. Wow. So amazing. 5 years on last Friday.
Nice. And Graham?
I got married in 1985, which means I've been married 34 years, I think.
I was five.
I was 10 in 1985.
I was minus something.
Yeah.
Well.
And you?
I've been married 16 years.
Mm-hmm. So you're winning, Graham. Well done.
I know. The weird thing is, people tell you this, like my parents used to tell me this when I was younger. They'd say, oh, it all goes really quick and you still feel the same as you did sort of at the beginning. You don't feel that much different. And it's actually true. Like, you look back on it, and of course you feel like you've been married 34 years in some ways, but in other ways you think, oh, I'm just still learning. I'm just kind of at the beginning, and it feels pretty much the same as the start. Still do the same old clunky things.
Right, so you've got little wisdom.
Is that what you're saying? Little wisdom to yeah. add. I've just got the Bible.
Great encouragement.
Okay.
I've got experience, which is sometimes beneficial. It's the application of the Bible and experience, which is sometimes a bit difficult.
I think we just now need to clarify, what do we mean by marriage? Because in our culture, marriage now has some very different terms. So I'm going to go to the director of affinity for that.
Well, I think the marriage is a covenantal relationship between a man and a woman for life. And by covenantal, I mean a commitment which is made before God, before other people, to each other, that says, I am committing to you, husband, wife, for the rest of our lives, as long as God gives us life together, to be together as a couple. And I'm committed to do that in a way that recognises who I am as a man or who I am as a woman, and recognises that I want to act out the roles that God has given me, and I want to love and to honour and to serve and to submit in the way that God calls me to do. So it's kind of a contract, but it's a loving contract, and it's a voluntary contract, and it's a joyful contract that you enter into.
Sounds good.
Should there be more? Am I missing something?
No, I think that's it. I think the clear definition, we're obviously in our culture, isn't it, man and a woman, whereas that has been redefined by our culture.
Yeah, I think that's been redefined, but also the contractual nature is still there, that it is a contract, but it's a temporary contract in our culture. So it's for as long as I feel like staying in this relationship. You know, people make all kinds of excuses about, well, we're living much longer, and so, you know, you can't possibly be committed to one person for, you know, for a long time until in your 70s. You kind of need another try with somebody else. Whereas a Christian view would be that it's a lifelong thing. And, you know, people joke about it, you know, being a kind of life sentence and all that, but it's just an amazing experience to grow together with someone through all the different stages. And although I'm still rubbish at being married, it has been fascinating kind of going through the different stages of life, having no kids, having kids, having teenage kids, having grown-up kids, having married kids, having now grandchildren. You kind of go through those different stages, and they're all brilliant fun, but different to go through. And they'll be kind of quite challenging stages. Not quite yet, but when you get, you know, much older and you know, I don't know, Carol and I joke about, you know, being unable to feed ourselves or whatever and needing help with that. And they're all challenging, but they're all kind of good stages of like living the whole of life together. I can currently still feed myself. Yeah, the guys are all laughing in here. Like, no, that's what he's like now. He's staggering around, and the food doesn't always sometimes make it to his mouth. But
there is a
joy in that. What were you thinking then?
I was imagining you and Caroline in a nursing home.
Yeah, well, quite.
Wheelchair. I was imagining. Yeah, instead of feeding yourselves, trying to feed each other.
Oh, kind of really sweet. Oh. But you see, I think the one half of me, that the unhealthy, unchristian half of me thinks, oh, that's a bit sad. In a sort of bad way, but
what's sad
to get to that stage? But the other half of me thinks, you know, if you're able to get to that stage, still love each other, still want to serve each other, still have a kind of delight in each other's company, that's a fantastic thing.
It's a miracle
to have got through. But it's also good in itself, but it's also built over the you know, the years of that covenantal relationship.
I think it's a good thing, Graham. Yep. Yeah, we like that. It's all right. Praise God. Let's think about just in terms of what it looks like biblically. So what is marriage biblically in terms of thinking through what it looks like? How does the Bible portray marriage? Just a few minutes on that before we get into some more practicalities of living the married life.
Yeah, don't you want to do that? You're just putting all the pressure on me this morning.
Yeah, it's fun watching.
What's the first marriage of the Bible? Or of all time?
Well, would it not be Adam and Eve? I think
it is Adam and Eve, recorded in Genesis.
And this is why we may employ you as our youth worker for profound knowledge like that, and insight on the Bible.
How do we know they were married?
Because there's a whole load of commentary around, this is why people, this is why a man leaves his family and cleaves.
Genesis 2.
Yeah, to his wife. So there's a... They obviously covenant together in a way they can't covenant with anyone else because there's no one else around. But the commentary on their relationship is that it is the first marriage and the pattern for all future marriages. So I think that's clear that they were married in that sense.
Say commentary, you're not thinking books outside of Bible, you're thinking what Jesus himself says and what Paul says.
And the commentary in Genesis itself, because obviously Moses, or almost certainly Moses, is writing the first five books of the Bible. And as he comments on that event, he puts it in the context of marriage.
Yeah.
So as he comments on Adam and Eve being together, being the one flesh kind of at the beginning, he connects that with marriage. So it's that commentary as well, and the rest of the commentaries in the rest of the Bible.
So that then just picks up in terms of what the Bible talks about, in terms of obviously Jesus holds marriage highly, but then you pick up Ephesians 5 and Paul's language in terms of actually marriage is reflecting Christ and his church. So actually the striking thing that we learn in the New Testament is that actually marriage is not just, hey, here's a picture of a man and woman, how to live family life from that, but also the fact that actually it's a reflection of Jesus and his church, which will then be presented for the whole of the new creation, where Jesus comes and we, his bride, are presented to him gloriously. So I think that's important, that actually as we do marriage, we're also a living, worked out example of what Christ and his church are as well.
And as marriage is an important thing, that God has made it that way and with his purposes, but we know from that there'll be no marriage in heaven.
What's your point?
Well, I think my point is holding it in, maybe this will come on some more practically thinking about, so marriage is a really important thing, but again, what we were talking about in the singleness one about identity in Christ and not being more completed because married or not, and the other way round for marriage, it's a wonderful thing, but it won't be forever.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think people who are married sometimes struggle with that, to be honest. lots of people I've spoken to who think that's a bit weird that I won't be married in heaven, because I've had, you know, particularly people who've been married a long time, and it's understanding about the quality of relationships and experience in the new heavens and new earth. So it won't be that we'll be downgraded in the new heavens and new earth. So we'll be downgraded from this really good relationship in marriage to a whole load of average relationships in the new heavens and earth, but rather that we'll be upgraded where everyone's having lots of close relationships. And I think there's a mystery, but I think there's good principle kind of principles in the Bible that would suggest that because we're going to recognize people, there's going to be some connection with that previous relationship. So I think he's particularly talking about the exclusive covenantal relationship ending, this is Jesus, in the new heavens and new earth, and there won't be sort of procreation and reproduction going on. He's not talking about the fact that we won't know our husband or wife and be able to relate to them. I assume from the rest of them, you guys are nodding, aren't you?
Yeah.
That you'll recognise your wife in heaven, presumably.
I often know her. Will you have a special connection still with them in a way that maybe? But then you're kind of into
I hope so.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Oh. But then you. No. But then you're into. What about those who have lost a husband or a wife and then have remarried?
Yeah.
So now you have two.
But that's why Jesus answers that question to say, there won't be anyone's husband or wife in heaven.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So probably not then.
Probably not in the same way. Mm-hmm. But I always just rest back on the simple fact that if God made this world and it's pretty amazing, he can make another one that's better.
I think that's sometimes the scary thing is you don't know what it's going to be like, but you can trust that it will be better, an improvement on.
Well, because at the end of the day, you trust in the one who made it, don't you? Yeah. That's the thing.
So coming back to this life and marriage, what else could we helpfully say about it?
Well, let's ask Keturah about the transition from singleness to marriage, because she was helping us last time to think about how to live a godly life as a single person, what that's like, the struggles of that and the good things in that. After you got married, how did that change things for you in terms of the time that you had free, or the your ability to serve in the church, or any other areas of your life? What changed?
Yeah, I wanted to, just as a follow-up of something I said in the last podcast, we can't always assume that most single people have a lot of time. So I had close friends who work long hours in London. You know, they have to run their own home. They do hospitality on their own. So it's we can't just assume that they have loads of free time. But you do have a different amount of time and times you're around. But for me, I think... time-wise, so I continued on in my job. I think a real joy for me was being able to serve with my husband in youth, serving together on a Sunday morning. But it was a big thing to get used to. And no matter how much you're prepared and told that marriage doesn't complete you, still in the back of your mind is this, do I feel like I've made it to a certain place? I've waited for this for a long time. But actually, then you get into marriage, realise you're the same person and you've just married another person, you know, a very important person to you. But you haven't changed. And so the things you battle with, you know, the same sins, the same struggles I had were there. And now I was just including someone else in on it.
That's a really good point. At the end of the day, it's two sinners who are getting married. Yeah. It's not like two perfect people. So two sinners are coming with all their sin, all their baggage, all their issues, and now you've got to try and work that through, which is why, you know, people say, you know, the first year of marriage is often hard, and it's hard because you're suddenly having to work out how two sinners live together in that way, alongside all the fun and the excitement of being newlyweds as well.
I think that must be one really important reason why we teach on singleness being a good thing and finding identity in Christ. Because if you, as a single person, are just looking to get married and looking forward to that, you're placing a burden upon that relationship, that future relationship, which it won't be able to bear.
Yeah, that's a real good point.
Because, you know, as you said, you realise that marriage doesn't complete you as a person once you get into it.
No, and once you're in it, you can start to practically work through that picture that Jesus gives of the church and his bride, and you know how you start to work through what that means for husband and wife in a relationship. Again, because it was a very much a kind of theory, and I'd seen it worked out in my parents' lives and friends around me. But then once you get into marriage, and that took time. So practically, time had to change in terms of the time that I gave to my marriage. But we were able to serve on camps together and continue in things.
I think the other side of the coin from the thing you were just talking about is that when you're single, particularly if you hope in God's goodness you might be married in God's plan, that you try and be as single person the person you want to be as a married person, rather than waiting to be married and then be good.
Yep.
So thinking about what kind of husband or wife would I like to be? I'd like to be like this. So let's be like this now. Often people who are single are a bit sort of undisciplined with whether it's sort of Bible reading or other things like that, or praying or evangelizing, and think, well, when I get in this sort of idealized Christian marriage, then I'll sort all those things out and we'll have daily Bible readings together and I'll be really unselfish. And of course, they wake up, you know, after the sort of honeymoon or the marriage thing. Yeah, as Kajura was saying, I'm still the same person. So one way around that is to be realistic that we're still sinners, but also to think in planning for marriage, let me try and be the Christian man, the Christian woman I want to be as a husband or a wife.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Well, can I just talk?
You don't want to contradict that, do you?
No, I don't. I want to rant for a thing. Because I think there's...
Okay, we're all going to stand back.
Yeah, rant. This is Mark's rant moment. I think a really unhelpful thing often taught, which is that, and particularly within conservative evangelical things, where we talk about, take the principle from Deuteronomy, which says, you know, a man should have the first marriage, his first year at home in his life, so not go off to war.
Yes.
And we take that, which is really all about protecting the legacy of heritage and having children and all the rest of it, and we apply that to our lives now, which says once a couple get married, they should not do anything for the first year together. And I think that's just a really dangerous principle, because I think actually, although you want to be investing in your marriage in your first year, absolutely, actually serving together is a really good way of investing in your marriage. So actually just saying, do you know what, we're just going to spend every night at home on our own and just enjoy being together, which is what you hear some say, actually I think just become inbreed a selfishness within the couple that actually don't help them to then go out and serve in the life of the church. Now there's a balance, because you don't want to be out every single night, because you've got to make sure that you have time for your husband and your wife, but actually serving together early on is actually a really good way of the spiritual formation in the life of a couple that then carries on. It's a habit that you input in the rest of your life.
So, yeah, it's really good if you can find ways. I mean, sometimes you can't find ways to serve together, but I think the experience of doing church life and serving in church and doing lots of other family stuff and lots of other friendship stuff is developing and creating an identity for you as a couple.
Well, so, for example, you know, trying to get to all the things that you can do as a couple within the life of the church is a helpful pattern that you want to establish early on.
Sure, and showing hospitality sort of early on.
Absolutely.
And it's fun, and sometimes it's a bit weird at first, because your husband or wife cooks a meal and people come around and it's not quite right, and because you're newly married you say something wrong about it, and not that I've ever done that, but you know, it goes wrong, or you know, something gets burnt and one or other of you is really upset, but you go through those experiences together. So there's lots of ways of serving which are not just going and serving at a club. There's serving in just interacting with people and showing hospitality,
sharing your life,
all those things which you want to start doing from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Rather than sort of hiding away and for the first bit. So I'm mostly with that rant.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Some people,
I feel like I've got it off my chest now. I feel so much better for it. It's like therapy.
Yeah. Some people might think, well, it's all right for you because, you know, you're in full-time church work, so you can sort of manage all your time around sort of being able to do church stuff. But, you know, I'm newly married and I've got quite a demanding job and I haven't got any time and those sort of things. So what would you say to them?
I would say, yeah, I have sympathy with that. But I think in fairness, it was actually, for us as in full-time ministry, it was actually equally as hard, because actually there was lots of pressure to be out every evening without my wife and lots of other meetings. So we had to find other ways of serving together and finding time that resisted that. So I think there's always pressures on everyone in these things. And of course, it's always a balance. But I think if you think you're going to be busy now as a young couple, it will only get harder if you have kids, and life never gets easier. You know, I think there's always that fallacy that if I've just wait to the next stage, or the next stage will come. But actually, life's always busy. And actually, you get to my age and you realise that you're kind of juggling both ends. You've got kids that you're trying to raise, and then you're starting to have to kick into caring for elderly, ageing parents. And so you suddenly got both ways, and you're at the point in your career where things are more responsibility. So actually, in every which way, pressure comes. So unless you've established those habits early on in the marriage life, actually it will just get harder. And I think not just serving together, but reading the Bible together, praying together, you know, trying to make these things habits, actually, if you start them early, will bear you up. Because if you think, I'll just wait until, it will never happen. Because it always things will get harder, busier, more demanding, if always.
We can refer people to our earlier podcast on Bible reading, but it's just worth underlining that we would highly recommend that in some way or other, couples do some Bible reading and prayer together. Sometimes people who've had a good sort of spiritual disciplined life before they get married, they continue that in a single way, even when they're married. So they say, well, I'm doing my bit of Bible reading and I'm doing my bit of Bible reading over here, but they're not doing it much together, in my observation. So really highly recommend. It may not be that you can do it in quite the same regularity, but in some regularity, reading the Bible and praying together.
Well, I was listening to it was a biography on Dallas Willard, and he was talking about how when he first got married, and he was obviously he's renowned for his kind of spiritual formation kind of thinking, and he was struck by actually it was all about himself, but then he realised actually more importantly he's got to start helping his wife, and actually much more important for that. And I thought, that's interesting. Often, as guys particularly, we forget that actually we have a real responsibility, Ephesians 5, to present our wives pure and perfect as best as one can, really. So we have a really integral role in that. And so we've got to be thinking about how we do that.
Do we have a couple of minutes to talk about headship, male headship, and maybe a couple of minutes to talk about when marriages break down? If you say no to that, it's going to be a bit of a disaster. You have to edit it out afterwards.
No, but I think there are two areas, aren't they, that are big. Because I was thinking, one of them is good just to think about where marriage breaks down, what are our observations of why that happens.
Sure.
So we'll tackle that. Headship, what do you want to say?
I think I just simply want to say, just for the record, that we believe the Bible teaches male headship, so a difference in role but not in status, as created equal male and female and saved equally, born of God, children of God, sons and daughters of God, but a difference in role in marriage, headship in the sense of a position of responsibility for the man as he serves as a servant leader, and submission in the case of the woman as she serves in her own way, but that kind of ultimate responsibility and authority resting with the man being what's taught in the Bible. And that's that's very countercultural. But it's the way God plans it, and it's the way it works best.
And I think the reason that often hits a bad vibe, as well, is because actually in our mind we have a Victorian model.
Sure.
So the whole kind of sense of the man is the head of his castle, king of his castle.
Yeah.
What he says goes. Yeah. His wife's not really allowed a view, and he must challenge. If he says this is what happens. He goes away and smokes his pipe, and everyone serves him.
Yeah.
Whereas actually the biblical view is much more of the husband laying down his life and serving his wife and family, actually giving up his rights, as it were, and much more concerned with how to serve. And I think when husbands do that, what happens is the wives flourish, and actually the relationship, the marriage, then thrives.
Yeah, and just this is not to be confused with gender stereotype roles. So this has nothing to do with what kinds of jobs in the house or in life a man or a woman does, which is great flexibility, much more flexibility than
sometimes we allow. Because again, I think we think it's all about stereotypes, that the woman must cook and the bloke must do the garden. And actually it could be completely the reverse and all sorts of things, and that's fine.
So what does it look like practically? I mean,
well, as long as I don't have to iron, that's the only thing.
Right.
Oh, I quite like ironing.
My husband does the cooking and the gardening.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Good question.
So if it doesn't work its way out though, in specific roles like those things, then how does it work its way out?
I think it works its way out, or works its way in the husband taking the responsibility for leading the family, not imposing authoritarianly, but in an authoritarian way, but in servant-hearted leadership. And I think that, of course, is the problem with authoritarian men, but probably in our culture, it's more of a problem with men just not even stepping up and taking responsibility. And often Christian women sort of having to drive their sort of men to take an interest. So it's a sacrificial taking an interest, taking responsibility, not a autocratic authoritarian approach. So I think how it cashes out is in just engaging with what's going on with your wife, and if you've got kids with your children, and making sure that we work hard at that. So we're getting a little bit short of time. That's why I hesitate.
I think it's the leading little wise. So I always, you know, think in terms of if you've had an argument, not that we would argue with her, but it's actually, I think it's the husband's responsibility to lead out to try and work that through. Yeah. You know, so in other words, I've got to swallow my pride and go and move towards my wife. It's that way around rather than expecting my wife to move towards me. It's all in those little details that at the end of the day, I have bottom end responsibility for the family life. That doesn't mean that I do everything or that my wife is not massively involved or helps and leads out in certain areas. That's not what you're saying at all. You know, but we are saying that we have responsibility in encouraging and flourishing and got that oversight. And how that works out in each marriage will be different. And I think in terms of thinking where marriage breaks down, I would say our observation is where often the guys have left. And not left the home physically, but they've left the home in terms of they're just not engaging. They're not seeking to really, not in every situation, but often that will be a picture of that.
Mm. Have you got, just before we finish, just some practical encouragements then for husbands on... Give something practical, like something more concrete on what that might look like. As in...
Yeah, I think so. I'm just worried that we like super run out of time.
It's okay.
Not more than the last one.
I thought when you said 3 minutes just now, that confused
me. One, leading out in devotion, spiritual devotions. Yeah. Two, leading out in prayers. Three, making sure leading out in terms of church, so spiritual areas.
Yes.
Thinking through, okay, we're taking, initiating communication. So actually it's not always the wife going, hey, we need to talk. Actually, no. Let's spend some time talking, actually making sure that they've kind of got an oversight of the manager of the week. It's not just leaving the wife to deal with everything.
It's a lot to do with working out what matters to the wife and making sure that you're engaged with that. The wife. I'm not saying...
The wife.
I'm just abstracting it, you know what I mean? You know, often my problem with my wife, Caroline, the wife, is that... I'm concerned with what I'm concerned with and my priorities and all the really important things I'm doing, of course. And there's other stuff that she's doing and she sometimes, as Mark says, initiates the conversation because I'm not really taking an interest. And, you know, part of leadership is saying, no, this is important to you, so it's now important to me to work out these practical arrangements or this thing that we really have to talk about, or, you know, this person that you're going to go and talk to and you really want to talk about how you speak to them and so forth. I think taking a leadership in that, taking responsibility in that, it's not really about some executive decision-making process. Sometimes people think, like, you know, the woman comes up with a series of, you know, list of things to be signed off, like you're some sort of chief executive of the home, and you sort of sign off and then you send them away from your study, you know, and, you know, carry on playing games on the computer or whatever, or smoking your pipe in Victorian era. It's, of course, in terms of, you know, big family decisions, you reach them together and you don't say, well, okay, you said your bit, but actually we're going to do this. That's not where the authority lands. It's much more, as Mark was saying, in terms of taking authority, taking responsibility, and actually caring and loving for your wife and loving your wife and family.
Great. Thank you. Thank you again, Keturah, for being with us for this podcast. It's been great to have a guest, and we will in future have more guests. We want to say thank you, and we'll catch you again another time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for sticking with us till the end. What a treat to have Keturah with us for two podcasts. And we have many exciting guests on the horizon, including, but not limited to, Glenn Scrivener, Tim Lane, and Helen Thorne. So stick around and keep sharing the podcast with your friends and family. Next week is our second edition of Ordinary Apologetics, so definitely join us for that one. It's going to be a lot of fun. See you then.